Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to bring a war criminal to trial? And are existing international laws and policies enough to ensure that all those responsible for broad-scale acts of inhumanity are brought to justice? The United Nations International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda were set up to do just that. For a time, both fell under the job description of a steely-nerved woman named Carla Del Ponte, who moved up the ranks from divorce attorney to mafia prosecutor and Swiss attorney general before being tapped by then-Secretary General Kofi Annan in 1999 to head the first international war crimes prosecutions since the Nuremberg and Tokyo trials. So what has come of Del Ponte's efforts, and what would she change about the UN if she could? Journalist Chuck Sudetic reported for the New York Times for 5 years on the breakup of Yugoslavia and worked as an analyst for the Yugoslavia Tribunal from 2001 through 2005. He is the co-author of Carla Del Ponte's new memoir called Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. Chuck, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
Her focus on seeking justice very often brings her up against what Italian speakers call the muro di gomma, the rubber wall. Can you talk about what that is?
Sure. The muro di gomma in this book is actually a metaphor for bureaucratic resistance to opening up to people from the outside. And in this instance, what we had were Carla Del Ponte, the prosecutor of the International War Crimes Tribunal for Yugoslavia and the Tribunal for Rwanda, was actually sitting at the head of a weak institution. It was one that depended upon voluntary support from states where war crimes had been committed or whose leaders had been indicted or suspected of war crimes to voluntarily cooperate in handing over evidence and arresting indicted individuals as well as protecting witnesses. Now, these people don't necessarily want to cooperate with a tribunal, and what they did, very few of them want to say, oh, Madame Del Ponte, when she goes into their office, very few leaders want to say, Madame Del Ponte, we don't agree with the idea of international justice, we're against it. Nobody wants to say that. So what they say is, oh, we really support what you're doing, we think it's a wonderful thing, and we'll do everything we can to help you. And then the meeting closes, she flies away, and a guy like me, an analyst or a lawyer, will walk in to a lower office and ask for evidence or ask for the police to arrest an indictee or ask for protection of a witness. And that's where the muro di gomma kicks in. You get delays, you get denials, you get, oh, this never existed, we don't have it, even though you may have registry numbers to particular documents, we don't have it, it never existed, and things like that, upon which, you know, when things like this happen, we would get on the phone again with Del Ponte and say, look, they're stonewalling us again. We've run into the muro di gomma, which is the wall of rubber. It's like the walls of a padded cell. You can rush up against them, and it won't kill you, but it'll hurt, and you'll feel the softness, but you'll find yourself right back to where you were. She would come in, and this is a woman with a strong, strong will, and she would pound tables until she broke through, and it made many, many individuals very, very upset with her very proactive and energetic method of work.
And part of the issue here is that her job and your job at the time was not to pick one side, the winning or the losing side, and sort of prosecute that for war crimes. In both of the cases that we've talked about here, in the former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda, there were atrocities committed by all sides.
Exactly. The book, Madam Prosecutor, gives an unprecedented look at an unprecedented process, and that is the creation of tribunals to try the highest-ranking individuals on all sides of particular conflicts. And the reason you want to have all sides represented is without all sides being examined. I mean, it could be that there aren't any on one side. It's hard to believe, but could be. Without having both sides looked at, examined, without having indictments drawn up against people where evidence exists of war crimes, you have no creation of a deterrent factor to future leaders, for one. Secondly, you don't give justice to the victims, and you allow yourself to have the beginning of cycles of violence, cycles of vengeance. And the third is you don't get a complete historical record, which means one side will have the ability to create a mythology that may lead to problems further down the pike. And in this instance, Madame Del Ponte was insistent that the all sides element of her mandate as the prosecutor was honored. And this, in Rwanda specifically, led to a movement in the United Nations Security Council spurred by the government of Rwanda, the Tutsi government of Rwanda, the present one, which is run by people who were representing a militia that was on the side of the victims of the genocide of 1994, to be clear, who had her removed from office because she was insistent upon prosecuting people against whom there was significant evidence that they had participated in massacres of Hutus.
And their official complaint, we should say, is that she wasn't spending enough time, that this was only part of her job, and they didn't feel like she was paying it due attention.
Right, exactly. And the problem with all that is that if people were, there was also allegations that that why do we have a white person running a court a prosecution effort in Black Africa? That was another thing that was said. Carla Del Ponte is not a racist. I can assure you that. But getting back to the original point, if it had been a matter of efficiency, then the subsequent prosecutor would certainly, after all the efficiencies had been improved, would certainly have gone on with the investigations and indictments against the people Del Ponte wanted to bring. And surprise, surprise, none of that has happened.
So why did Secretary Annan cave at that point?
It wasn't Secretary Annan that caved in at that point. Secretary Annan was not the boss of Carla Del Ponte. The United Nations Security Council was the boss of Carla Del Ponte. They were the ones who were responsible. And it was this gets into the realm of Muro de Goma protecting diplomatic interests. This was in 2003. Madame Del Ponte's first 4-year term was about to expire. And the governments of Great Britain and the United States, among others, saw Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, who was the leader of the militia that committed these, allegedly committed these acts of violence against Hutu civilians, who had been taken on as a kind of our guy in the region. And what we've heard is they were into protecting his position. At one point, I want to speak in specific terms about this because I think it's important. The crime that Del Ponte wanted to investigate in the Rwanda context against the Tutsis was the murders of 10 to 12 Roman Catholic clerics who were taken prisoner on a day during the genocide by Tutsi militia and were held for a number of days and moved around. So it was their deaths. Finally, they were executed after 4 or 5 days, I believe. Their deaths did not take place as an act of passion. It was an act of premeditation. And the question was, how far up the chain of command did it go? And at first, Kagame's people said they would cooperate with Madame Del Ponte in going forward with the investigation. And then, all at once, the door slammed shut, and the investigation. They were told no investigation of any Tutsis would be allowed, and then the diplomatic effort began to remove her from the position. The chronology just matches up. As I say that, I just wanted to step back because some people may be offended. This is not in any way to diminish the seriousness of the genocide by the Hutu against the Tutsi in Rwanda. 800,000 people were killed. And the world stood by and did nothing. This is a horrible, horrible injustice. But the point here is that the tribunal is out to do justice for victims on all sides. They were doing work on gathering evidence and presenting indictments against the leaders of the Hutus who carried out the order giving and the media work and the political backing for the genocide. These guys are the high end people. They're not the machete wielders. They're the guys who handed out the orders. They went and energetically pursued those guys and pretty much got them. But, you know, as I said, you can't have a deterrent created unless you speak to both sides. And Rwanda is a great case in point where the allowance of a kind of tit-for-tat over a number of decades since the end of the colonial rule of the Belgians in Rwanda led to the animosities created, terrible animosities created between the Hutus and the Tutsis, and a back and forth of violence that finally exploded in its most heinous form with the genocide, and has since spilled into the Congo, where since 94, 98, somewhere in the late 90s, you have 3.1 million people dead in a war that's largely fought by Tutsis on Hutus, and then with a spillover into local Congolese units.
Chuck Sidetic is my guest. He is co-author of the book Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. It's a memoir written by Carla Del Ponte, who is the former chief prosecutor for the UN International Criminal Tribunal set up for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda. Let's talk for a minute about Carla Del Ponte. This is a woman who has always been courageous. Her first job was snake hunting.
Well, it wasn't her first. It was a kiddie job.
Right.
Exactly. When she was a kid, she took piano lessons, and next door to the place where she took piano lessons, or down the block, was a venom extraction operation, and people were paying money for poisonous snakes, and she and her brothers got together when I think she was 10 years old at the time, which tells you she rode the trains by herself at 10 in Switzerland, which kind of tells you the kind of place she grew up. And they went off into the woods with their dog Clyde and collected poisonous snakes and took them down and kept the money away from their mothers, but their mother didn't know about it. This is the kind of person we're talking about. And, you know, she's also the product of, I think, very interesting. She had a really strong-willed mother who wanted her to go out in the world and make something of herself instead of becoming, you know, just a, you know, a Swiss housewife. She was kind of a Heidi character growing up, a tomboy in the mountains of southern Switzerland, the Italian-speaking canton there. And, you know, so as I said, she went on to get involved in the mafia prosecutions in Italy, and her role in this was to walk into the offices of the Swiss banks, which were at the time protected by quite strong bank secrecy laws, and go into the faces of bankers time and time and time again and inform them that the laws had chinks in them through which a prosecutorial effort could demand to look at the books if the assets were the result of criminal activity. And she was able to bring forth enough evidence in some of these cases to open up the books on the Sicilian Mafia, including the Pizza Connection, which involved drug trafficking into the United States. Subsequent to that, when she became the Attorney General of Switzerland, she participated with many others in an effort to eliminate entire sections of the bank secrecy law in Switzerland, which allowed for an even greater view of accounts that were kept by corrupt politicians from around the world, including Mexico and Pakistan.
We'll talk more about that after the break with Chuck Sidetic. He is a journalist who covered the breakup of Yugoslavia for the New York Times and then worked as an analyst for the Yugoslavia Tribunal for the United Nations from 2001 through 2005. He's co-author of the new book, Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. If you want to join us, you can get on the line now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Chuck Sudetic. He is co-author of the new memoir, Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. It's the story of Carla Del Ponte, who is the UN's former chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. As we know, Chuck, it's not difficult to make enemies in the mafia if you go up against them. They gave her a sort of horrible nickname. They killed her supervisor, and they tried to kill her.
Well, they didn't kill her. The supervisor you're talking about was Giovanni Falcone, who was the most famous Nazi prosecutor in Sicilian history. And they killed his successor as well, another one of Del Ponte's collaborators in this effort. It's serious stuff. And they attempted to blow her up with Giovanni Falcone one day on a beach in Sicily. It's a dangerous job.
And what this did for her is, instead of sort of causing her to retreat from this effort, she just got angry.
She got angry, but she got harder-headed.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't shirk. You can talk a lot about people facing death threats, and you can talk a lot about, you know, bombs and things. Right? These are serious things when you deal with the mafia. But in her job as a, just to give you an idea of the fortitude of this woman, in her job as a war crimes prosecutor, the thing that she faced that would drive most people to depression was the constant criticism from all sides for taking an energetic stance, and in many ways an uncompromising stance, in demanding that governments that had pledged to cooperate with the tribunal actually fulfilled those pledges. In other words, that governments where a president or a general had been indicted would actually go out and arrest them. She didn't get help much from the media, because the media got tired of the constant drum roll. It was the same message over and over again. There wasn't much news in it until somebody was arrested, and that was only happy news. The diplomatic community, while they did support, there's much support that came internationally to her. There was also tremendous amounts of backstabbing, because when Del Ponte brings a prosecutorial effort into the diplomatic realm, she makes life a lot more complicated for people like United Nations or United Nations officials on the ground, or United States ambassadors, or the heads of the military consulate offices in the embassies. And she made life very difficult. And once again, the local governments couldn't stand her, because when she came to town, she was not there to deliver flowers. She was there to deliver a message that we need this cooperation. We need it immediately. We're tired of waiting. And she would go off and do things like speak with the foreign minister of the Secretary of State of the United States, Colin Powell, who was a hero in this story in vis-a-vis the Milosevic case.
George Tenet, not so much, we should say.
George Tenet, not so much in the prologue of our book, but that was just an expression of an attitude. She did get some help out of the CIA. It's not to say that they didn't receive it, but Del Ponte was looking for a more proactive cooperation that the CIA agents spy agencies don't want to cooperate with ad hoc groups too much, because they're very, very territorial when it comes, and protective of their sources for many, many good reasons, as it points out in the prologue to the book. But what Colin Powell did was say, go ahead to Del Ponte and assure her that Serbia, for example, would not receive financial aid or clearance for financial aid from the USG, the United States government, unless they cooperated with the tribunal in the handover of Milosevic. Carla Del Ponte took that right back to Serbia and said, if you don't hand over, you're not going to get help from the U.S., and the U.S. is key to getting help from the IMF and all these other international financial institutions. And eventually they caved, but not before the Secretary of the General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, sent her a letter and said, cease and desist from linking financial aid to the arrest of war crimes. And when Del Ponte got it, she politely read it and dismissed it out of hand.
You know,
went on linking it, and it proved, extremely effective in getting people to cooperate and do what they had promised to do, hand over witnesses, hand over evidence, and hand over indictees, hand over evidence, and protect witnesses.
If there is one thing, Chuck, that comes through in this book over and over and over again, it's how very often and inappropriately the United Nations sort of gets in the way of its own mission when it comes to criminal justice.
Well, you've got to remember, when you talk, the United Nations was running the UN tribunals for Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, but the UN on the ground, they carry a diplomatic mission, which is often at odds with what Del Ponte wants. They want to have, for example, in Kosovo, that's the best example of it in the book, in Kosovo, after the 1999 bombing where the Serbian authorities withdrew and a nascent Albanian government was taking place, a UN mission was set up there, and the book describes in very concrete detail how, while there was some expressions of support and there was concrete support given by some elements of the UN mission down there, and especially on the NATO side of the international effort to protect the workers, to protect the investigators, to help in the gathering of some information, the UN was reluctant to provide support for another UN agency. So there was an interagency conflict here. And as I said, the book describes it in great detail, and it should stand as a lesson to both prosecutors and UN officials moving forward as to what not to do in the future of this thing. You know, the problem of witness protection in Kosovo is huge, and it led to the collapses of several cases because witnesses who came forward and gave statements withdrew them or disappeared or just declined to come and testify.
The book is called Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. Co-author Chuck Sudetic is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Christopher in Fort Worth. Hello, Christopher.
Hi. I was curious about whether the author or the subject of the book had any influence or dealings with the current trial of Charles Taylor in The Hague, and what he feels about the impact of that case on trying war criminals, especially former leaders of countries.
Thanks for your call.
In reference to Carla Del Ponte, she was the prosecutor of the Yugoslavia and the Rwanda tribunals. She was not the prosecutor in the Sierra Leone tribunal, the special court for Sierra Leone, which is trying Charles Taylor. Chuck, on the other hand, has lived in The Hague for a while and has a lot of friends who are involved in the effort. And the prosecution of Charles Taylor, this is the Blood Diamond King of West Africa, can only contribute to the creation of the kind of deterrent factor international justice is designed to create. This is a man who thought he could get away with anything and make himself immensely rich at the same time. Anybody who wants to read a catalog of depravity can go online to the Sierra Leone Tribunal and actually read through the testimonies of some of the soldiers under Charles Taylor during his efforts to take over and control the diamond-rich areas of Sierra Leone. And my suggestion is that they have a strong stomach to read it.
We should point out we have an email here to think@kera.org from Nicole in Dallas, who mentions that in 2006 she was traveling to visit friends who live near The Hague. and set about discovering what would be going on as far as the International Court and the UN tribunals and how one could gain entry as an observer. As it turns out, she writes, it wasn't that complicated to get in, she thinks Think listeners are probably just the kind of people who'd be interested in doing that, and she would recommend it if you're traveling to the Netherlands.
Absolutely. I've had friends come from the U.S. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and I've had friends come from Cleveland, Ohio and told me that was the best part of their trip to Holland.
Wow.
It's quite amazing when you hear, especially if you have a witness who's very, very compelling and graphic in the testimony, but just the idea of sitting there behind a bulletproof glass wall and seeing the likes of Slobodan Milosevic or Milan Lukic, one of the killers of the Bosnian War, sitting there in the dock 15 feet away. It's very, very, very... a compelling way to spend your afternoon. I would recommend it to everyone. But you know, you can watch the proceedings on the internet live. They're all presented at ICTY, the ICTY's website. Just put ICTY into Google search, and it'll pop right up, and then you can go right to the video at any time and watch.
An interesting aside here, as Swiss Attorney General, before she had any specific responsibility at all for the situation in the former Yugoslavia, she seriously considered arresting Radovan Karadzic. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's just a funny anecdote. There was a conference in Switzerland during the war in Bosnia, at which the leadership of the different groups were brought in by another United Nations entity, the peace mission was international, but one half of it was UN. And, they were brought in. And the question is, would she have been able to get away with it? Because these guys probably came under some kind of diplomatic immunity at the time, because they were answering an invitation from the UN. But, yeah, she wanted to go after. She asked her staff to look at whether it was possible to find charges that could be sustained and to arrest him when he was on Swiss soil,
I wonder if you can talk about your response and Ms. Del Ponte's when Karadzic was finally arrested and the circumstances by which he was caught and discovered.
Well, the circumstances, you know, there's a lot of myth out there about Karadzic, and he was dressed like he was looking a lot like Santa Claus and
working as a doctor, right?
Mystical medicine. Excuse me?
He was working as a doctor, some sort of a...
Yeah, he was a psychiatrist before the war, and he was working as a kind of alternative medical provider. He was a kind of new age style healer, and he had a strong following. It's laughable to believe that the government of Serbia did not know exactly where he was all the time, and lo and behold, not long before Mr. Karadzic was arrested, there was an election in Serbia in which his main protector, Vojislav Koštunica, was removed from power. And without that protection, then the powers in Serbia could assert their will, the Democratic Forces, Democratic Party, assert their will and have Karadzic arrested. The last big indictee still at large is Ratko Mladic, who was, together with Karadzic, the main order givers for the Srebrenica massacre of 1995, in which 7,500 to 8,000 prisoners were shot within a period of 5 days, Muslims, taken prisoners, some of them as young as 10, 12 years old. By best evidence right now, he's being protected by elements of the army of Serbia, and the political leadership isn't strong enough to overcome that resistance.
Yeah, there's a sense that many people who ought to be giving up this information know exactly where he is.
Oh, yeah, no. It's silly to believe that people don't know where he is. You know, the tribunal may not know where he is, and outsiders may not know where he is, but to believe that the authorities in Serbia don't know where he is, a man like that, or couldn't find him within a matter of an hour, is laughable.
Any interest in the theory that he may have actually died?
If he had actually died, I think they would have let it be known. There were a lot of rumors, and I think a lot of this is these are red herrings created to sort of take people off the path. There were rumors years ago that he had suffered a stroke and was no longer capable of withstanding trial. Well, if that's so, then why don't you just let the world know about it?
Chuck Sudetic is my guest. He's co-author of the new book, Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. Let's go next on the line to Frank in Dallas. Hey, Frank.
Hi, my name is Frank. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, hi.
My question is this. We saw in Congo, we got like 6 million people killed. And the person who killed these people, everybody knows, especially supported by the U.S. government to protect him. We saw the same person is the president of Rwanda right now. Before to be president of Rwanda, this guy, he killed 1,000 people in Uganda. And he crossed the border. He killed people in Congo. He killed people everywhere. Mm-hmm. Nobody punished him. Carla De La Ponte, she was pushed pressure to him to be prosecuted, and they kick him out. What they now, if the Obama government, then I keep protect this guy. That's my question.
That's a great question. And we referred to it before in stressing the necessity of pursuing cases against individuals on all sides. And as we said, the Rwanda tragedy of 1994 was, and the Congo tragedy that has gone on since then, are largely the result of a tit for tat that began way back at the end of the colonial era when the Belgians moved out, and there was a conflict between the two groups in that part of the world, in both Rwanda, Burundi, and Eastern Congo. And the violence has only escalated, and no deterrence has ever been created yet. And the only hope that the only hope for international justice in creating a deterrent is to go after individuals on all sides. And as I said before, since Del Ponte was removed in 2003 from the position of prosecutor in the Rwanda Tribunal, there hasn't been a prosecution of anybody except Hutus.
Chuck Sudetic is my guest. He is a former reporter for the New York Times, has also worked as an analyst for the Yugoslavia Tribunals of the United Nations International Criminal Tribunals. We will return to our discussion in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Chuck Sudetic. He is co-author of the book, Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. It is a memoir also by Carla Del Ponte. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. One of the most stunning allegations when the book was first published in Italian was this idea that Kosovo Serbs who were kidnapped during and after the war were murdered in Albania, in some cases after having their vital organs removed and sold on the black market.
Right. That's the reason I'm speaking with you today instead of Carla Del Ponte, because the Swiss government, which recognized that Kosovo as an independent state in the days just preceding the publishing of the book in Italian last spring, has put a gag order on Del Ponte because she's now the ambassador of Switzerland to Buenos Aires in Argentina, and they can apply that kind of discipline over her. This, I think, in my opinion, reveals the very sensitive nature of recognition of Kosovo when everybody knows that the government of Kosovo has some serious problems in the law and order department, and especially with some of the individuals who are involved in running that government. The allegations that we raise, they're allegations in some areas and they're just assertions in others, was an effort to let people know that there were some serious violations of law that took place after the end of the armed conflict in Kosovo, so after the end of the NATO bombing in June of 1999. And what these involved were kidnappings by Albanians of approximately, as we know now, 400 Serbs. In the book, I was pretty conservative in what number we would use. It was 100 to 300 based upon information that had come to the UN. 100 to 300 individual people were what we had knowledge of when we were doing the book up. It's about 400. They were individually kidnapped. They were transported across the border into Albania. They were killed. And there were that's an allegation. It's pretty much an assumed fact that you know it's an operating assumption by the UN authorities in Kosovo that they're across that border and that they're dead. The assertion that came to the UN from a couple of journalists who were tracing these kidnappings was that perhaps some of them had fallen afoul of an organized effort to extract organs and to sell them on the world market. So you would pay somebody for their kidney, for example, fly it to another state where people were willing to pay, people who are in serious need of organs were willing to pay for it. In many cases, up to in the six-figure area. And the assertions came to the tribunal through the UN in Kosovo, and the journalists who had brought them went to a house and found some very interesting evidence and took it to the they told the UN about it and said, we think you should come and look at it. They did the right thing by bringing in the strongest law enforcement effort that they could find, the UN in Kosovo, and then the UN in Kosovo reached out to the ICTY, the Yugoslavia Tribunal in The Hague. And they went to a house where their sources had said this activity or parts of this activity had gone on. And they found on the ground around the house spent syringes. They found gauze-like material that was consistent with surgical masks. They found used vials of medicine that contained a kind of muscle relaxant used in surgical work. And then they went inside the house and asked the people there if anything had ever happened here. And, of course, the answer was no, this is only our living room. We do nothing but watch TV here. And they said, did anything ever happen with blood here? And, of course, they said no. And then they sprayed the luminol. It was like a CSI episode. And the place lit up. They went to the next room and asked the same thing. And, of course, no. And once again, the luminol was sprayed, and it once again lit up. Now, none of this is proof that any crime was committed, but it's compelling, corroborating evidence to the assertions that were raised that brought them there in the first place. Del Ponte's operation, the ICTY, could not investigate this crime because under the rules of the ICTY, you can only investigate war crimes. That means they must take place during the armed conflict. So, because they took place after the armed conflict ended, there was no jurisdiction to go forward. No prosecutor in his right mind wants to invest in a prosecution that it knows the judge will throw out as soon as it lands on the judge's desk, because there's no jurisdiction. So it was incumbent upon the UN in Kosovo, the government of the Republic of Albania, where this house was situated and where these deaths allegedly occurred, and whatever NASA authorities there were in Kosovo to go forward. And nothing happened. In the 3 years after this visit, nothing was undertaken to investigate it. And we knew that this had been found. And the point of this was to, and once again, I have to say this also, that the evidence that the sources brought forward were from Albanians, not from Serbs. There were Albanians that they wanted an independent Kosovo state like every other Albanian. They didn't want to have an independent Kosovo state at any cost. And by that, I mean at the cost of having a state that's not ruled by the rule of law. They brought the information forward at great risk, by the way. And we said, this 400 people kidnapped off streets when NATO is basically in situ in the country, that should not go without some kind of investigatory effort. And we threw it into the book to show, A, the kind of stuff you get, and it's very frustrating when you can't go after it, and B, to try to promote an effort to get an investigation started, And so far in that period, we've been supported by Human Rights Watch, which essentially went off and found a document that we didn't have that supported exactly what we said in terms of the findings of this investigatory trip into Albania. And that has promoted a investigation by the Council of Europe. And hopefully we're going to see some evidence come out in the next 6 weeks or so that will promote, will make it incumbent upon the UN and others to launch a criminal investigation into this activity.
You also now have Florence Hartman, who is a former colleague of yours and a spokeswoman for Carla Del Ponte, on trial at the tribunal. Can you talk a little bit about that case?
To be honest with you, I don't know very much about it, but I'm pretty. I think it's an outrageous accusation that's against her. The idea of going after Hartman for revealing things that are basically public knowledge seems to me that there was some inside personal gripe that somebody had with Ms. Hartman that might have prompted somebody to do this. I don't know. I think it's a waste of time, a waste of money, and isn't going to bring anything into the open. And it's not going to help deterrence for war crimes. It's not going to help bring justice to victims. And it certainly isn't going to help protect any witnesses or improve a historical record. To me, it's pretty outrageous. You know, I'd like to go back and just add to, I think that the gentleman that asked about the Rwanda president asked another thing, and that was where we are now and what President Obama might want to do about this business in Congo. And I think that that's a really good question. I think that the violence in eastern Congo is of such a dimension. It's the largest death rate since World War II in the world. It's very, very underreported. And also, in addition to that, there is a horrible, 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 beyond imagination horrible, gender crime going on, the rapes. And that area is being plundered largely through Rwanda for its metal wealth. The stuff that goes into the making of the cellular phones that practically everybody that's listening to this broadcast in Dallas right now or in North Texas right now holds in their pocket or their hand comes from that place. And this is something that, you know, it's not so far away as your pocket. And it's something I think the U.S. government should take a serious look at. And I know they are. I mean, it's not as if they aren't, but there's got to be some effective action taken to stop this.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Barbara in Fort Worth. Hi, Barbara.
Hello, Chris. Is this Chris?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi. First of all, thank you to your guests for mentioning those rapes in Congo. They're appalling. But my real question is, historically, in Rwanda especially, the Tutsis and the Hutus, it's my information from 20 years ago that the Tutsis were actually Arabs in origin, and they were slave traders. And the Hutus were the slaves, which leads to more recent events. Is that totally off the wall? Are you familiar with that? Do you think it has any relevance to today?
I'm not an expert on Rwanda. The background that I did for the book was led back to the time of the animosities led back to the time of colonization. When the Tutsis, a minority group, were used by the Belgians as the they weren't the slave traders, they were sort of the masters of the labor during that period, and that set off a lot of animosities in there. You know, this is the land, remember, when we start talking about Belgium and the Congo and Rwanda, you're talking about the heart of darkness. You know, there's fantastic stories of depravity brought on by the effort to extract wealth by the colonial masters, the Belgians. It's not a happy story by any stretch. And as I said, you know, look at the violence that we have today. You know, the other thing I wanted to bring up is one of the great human rights investigators from that part of the world, Alison DeForge from Human Rights Watch. This is a woman that was in Rwanda at the time of the genocide and who was pounding tables and demanding action be taken to stop it. And then afterwards, investigated the violence against Hutus by Tutsis, by the Kagame people. She was eventually driven away from Rwanda by the Tutsis. know, the same people that she was investigating on behalf of during the genocide didn't want her around anymore. And I really think she needs to be mentioned because Allison died tragically in the plane crash in Buffalo, New York, her hometown, just a few weeks ago. And the world really lost a really, really valuable soul in her death.
The book concludes, Chuck, with a list of different ideas for improving the way this is done and ensuring that the justice is in fact served. One of the key things that needs to be looked at, according to the book, is giving the tribunal more power than the humanitarians, than the developers, than even the peacekeepers within the United Nations. Can you sort of explain how that would play out and why it would make
a difference? Well, I'm not exactly sure how it would play out, and I'm not exactly sure whether a sort of wish list, a bullet point on a wish list like that will ever materialize, because when you start talking about that, you're talking about infringing upon sovereignty, which is a vital element of the way the world is organized in our world. But it underscores how weak the tribunals in the international justice effort are. You don't have the kind of subpoena power to go and grab documents, say, that the public prosecutor in Dallas or in any county in North Texas would have. If they think that somebody's got bank records which show that there's criminal activity and they can prove within reason that exists and there's cause, they'll get a judge to sign it, and the person has to sign to hand it over. That's not the case for the tribunal. If there's a witness that needs to be protected, that, in this instance, you find witnesses, you would not believe the courage of the witnesses and the will that they have to come to testify against the accused and to see justice done. Because generally, when you talk about witnesses, you're talking about to the crimes. You're talking about people who've lost their families or who have suffered wounds or whatever to do so. And in many cases, the accused still have capacity on the ground to eliminate these people, to go after them, to go after members of their family, to kidnap their children. And the tribunal's ability to protect witnesses in places like Kosovo, for example, is very, very weak and needs to be strengthened. And in that instance, there should be more authority, I think, in the hands of the tribunal over UN missions in places like Kosovo to demand that they actually get into the business of protecting people rather than being fixated upon their diplomatic or their development goals.
Chuck Sudetic reported for the New York Times for 5 years on the breakup of Yugoslavia. He later worked as an analyst for the Yugoslavia Tribunal. He is the co-author of a new memoir called Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. Chuck, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.